In the pre-dawn darkness of August 26, 1929, in the back bedroom of a small house in Torrance, California, a 12-year-old boy sat up in bed listening. There was a sound coming from outside, growing ever louder. It was a huge, heavy rush, suggesting immensity, a great parting of air. It was coming from directly above the house. The boy swung his legs off his bed, raced down the stairs, slapped open the back door, and loped onto the grass. The yard was otherworldly, smothered in unnatural darkness, shivering with sound. The boy stood on the lawn beside his older brother, head thrown back, spellbound. The sky had disappeared. An object that he could see only in silhouette, reaching across a massive arc of space, was suspended low in the air over the house. It was longer than 2.5 football fields, and as tall as a city. It was putting out the stars. What he saw was the German dirigible Graf Zeppelin. At nearly 800 feet long and 110 feet high, it was the largest flying machine ever crafted. More luxurious than the finest airplane, gliding effortlessly over huge distances, built on a scale that left spectators gasping, it was, in the summer of 29, the wonder of the world. The airship was 3 days from completing a sensational feat of aeronautics, circumnavigation of the globe. The journey had begun on August 7th, when the Zeppelin had slipped its tethers in Lakehurst, New Jersey, lifted up with a long, slow sigh, and headed for Manhattan. On Fifth Avenue that summer, demolition was soon to begin on the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, clearing the way for a skyscraper of unprecedented proportions, the Empire State Building. At Yankee Stadium in the Bronx, players were debuting numbered uniforms. Lou Gehrig wore number 4. Babe Ruth, about to hit his 500th home run, wore number 3. On Wall Street, stock prices were racing toward an all-time high. After a slow glide around the Statue of Liberty, the Zeppelin banked north, then turned out over the Atlantic. In time, land came below again. France, Switzerland, Germany. The ship passed over Nuremberg, where fringe politician Adolf Hitler, whose Nazi party had been trounced in the 1928 elections, had just delivered a speech touting selective infanticide. Then it flew east to Frankfurt, where a Jewish woman named Edith Frank was caring for her newborn, a girl named Anne. Sailing northeast, the Zeppelin crossed over Russia. Siberian villagers, so isolated that they'd never even seen a train, fell to their knees at the sight of it. On August 19th, as some 4 million Japanese waved handkerchiefs and shouted Banzai, the Zeppelin circled Tokyo and sank onto a landing field. 4 days later, as the German and Japanese anthems played, the ship rose into the grasp of a typhoon that whisked it over the Pacific at breathtaking speed toward America. Passengers, gazing from the window, saw only the ship's shadow, following it along the clouds, like a huge shark swimming alongside. When the clouds parted, the passengers glimpsed giant creatures turning in the sea that looked like monsters. On August 25th, the Zeppelin reached San Francisco. After being cheered down the California coast, it slid through sunset into darkness and silence and across midnight. As slow as the drifting wind, it passed over Torrance, where its only audience was a scattering of drowsy souls, among them the boy in his pajamas, behind the house on Gramercy Avenue. Standing under the airship, his feet bare in the grass, he was transfixed. It was, he would say, fearfully beautiful. He could feel the rumble of the craft's engines tilling the air, but couldn't make out the silver skin, the sweeping ribs, the finned tail. He could see only the blackness of the space it inhabited. It was not a great presence, but a great absence, a geometric ocean of darkness that seemed to swallow heaven itself. The boy's name was Louis Silvier Zamperini, the son of Italian immigrants. He had come into the world in Olean, New York, on January 26, 1917, 11.5 pounds of baby, under black hair as coarse as barbed wire. His father, Anthony, had been living on his own since age 14, first as a coal miner and boxer, then as a construction worker. His mother, Louise, was a petite, playful beauty, 16 at marriage and 18 when Louis was born. In their apartment, where only Italian was spoken, Louise and Anthony called their boy Toots. From the moment he could walk, Louis couldn't bear to be corralled. His siblings would recall him careening about, hurdling flora, fauna, and furniture. The instant Louise thumped him into a chair and told him to be still, he vanished. If she didn't have her squirming boy clutched in her hands, she usually had no idea where he was. In 1919, when two-year-old Louis was down with pneumonia, he climbed out his bedroom window, descended one story, and went on a naked tear down the street with a policeman chasing him and a crowd watching in amazement. Soon after, on a pediatrician's advice, Louise and Anthony decided to move their children to the warmer climes of California. Sometime after their train pulled out of Grand Central Station, Louis bolted, ran the length of the train, and leapt from the caboose. Standing with his frantic mother as the train rolled backward in search of the lost boy, Louis's older brother, Pete, spotted Louis strolling up the track in perfect serenity. Swept up in his mother's arms, Louis smiled. "I knew you'd come back," he said in Italian. In California, Anthony landed a job as a railway electrician and bought a half-acre field on the edge of Torrance, population 1,800. He and Louise hammered up a one-room shack with no running water, an outhouse behind, and a roof that leaked so badly that they had to keep buckets on the beds. With only hook latches for locks, Louise took to sitting by the front door on an apple box with a rolling pin in her hand, ready to brain any prowlers who might threaten her children. There, and at the Gramercy Avenue house where they settled a year later, Louise kept prowlers out, but couldn't keep Louis in hand. Contesting a foot race across a busy highway, he just missed getting broadsided by a jalopy. At 5, he started smoking, picking up discarded cigarette butts while walking to kindergarten. He began drinking one night when he was 8. He hid under the dinner table, snatched glasses of wine, drank them all dry, staggered outside, and fell into a rose bush. On one day, Louise discovered that Louis had impaled his leg on a bamboo beam. On another, she had to ask a neighbor to sew Louis's severed toe back on. When Louis came home drenched in oil after scaling an oil rig, diving into a sump well, and nearly drowning, it took a gallon of turpentine and a lot of scrubbing before Anthony recognized his son again. Thrilled by the crashing of boundaries, Louis was untamable. As he grew into his uncommonly clever mind, mere feats of daring were no longer satisfying. In Torrance, a one-boy insurgency was born.